Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. The Harvard Business Review just released a report detailing that gender pay gaps shrink when companies are required to disclose them. The article states that the government-mandated reporting of gender pay discrepancies has been a subject of much debate in the last 5 to 10 years. They go on to state that those arguing for legislation to require such reporting say that it'll help to address persistent gender wage gap. Opponents insist that not only is it unlikely that it will increase companies' administration burden and decrease profits. They explain in the article that they've just conducted their first empirical study on the impact of mandatory wage transparency. The study results suggest that disclosing disparity in gender pay does, in fact, narrow the gender wage gap. All right, moving in the right direction here. It also can, according to what they said, it also can increase the number of women being hired. It can increase the number of female employees being promoted from the bottom of the hierarchy to more senior positions, and it can lower companies' overall wage bills, largely by slowing down the growth of male wages. There you go. This was based on involvement from numerous different countries that are part of the OECD, which is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Countries included in this is most of the EU, North America, South America, a lot of South America, Japan, South Korea. And mostly what they're saying is that the countries, it's not mandatory in most countries. There are some that are partaking now, but they're encouraging more groups to partake in this conversation. And just to add a little more context to that, the highest discrepancy in wage pay between men and women was in Korea, which was 37%, and the lowest in these OECD countries was Luxembourg with 3.7%. They close the article by talking about their study and stating that our research suggests that the government's efforts to address these disparities through transparency can be effective and beneficial to firms as well as to their female employees. Well, there's more than one way to skin a cat. Our guest today has taken matters into her own hands and changed our expectations for what is just and what can be done in short order. Focused on leveraging stakeholder capital to balance the power, she's already taken on the gender pay gap, environmental abusers, political stalwarts, and social dinosaurs to drive change now. Today, we welcome Natasha Lamb, who's the managing partner at Arjuna Capital. Hey, Natasha, how are you?
I'm good, Aaron. Happy to be here.
Well, it is our pleasure to have you. I've had a chance to see some of your speaking engagements. I've had a chance to come to one of your events up in Manchester by the Sea, up in the North Shore, very near to where I live. Exciting to see such incredible, thought-provoking conversations and such impactful work that's affecting much of our country right here in the North Shore of Massachusetts.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hey. I didn't do the work. All I have to do is repeat it. So you did all the hard work. That's good stuff. All right. Let me just read a little bit about Arjuna Capital, and then we'll go into some of the specific questions relating to the gender pay gap, and then also relating to some of the things that are correlating to the environmental issues and social consciousness. So Arjuna Capital overview states that sustainable investing starts with the understanding that a just society, a healthy environment, and competitive financial returns are all bottom line issues. The Arjuna Capital team brings 5 decades of sustainable investing experience to the partnership we forge with our clients. Together, we invest in the kind of world we want to live in. Arjuna Capital works with high net worth individuals, families, and foundations to create a suite of sustainable investments that make sense to and for the clients. At the heart of these relationships is an ongoing in-depth conversation about ways clients want to put their money to work. All right. So Natasha, if I fell into one of these buckets, I got some work to do. The podcasting gig isn't paying that well yet these days, but we're getting there. We're moving in the right direction. But if I was in one of these things, What's the value proposition to why this new bottom line of values is the place for me to invest?
Yeah, I mean, the underlying thesis is that sustainability is just better business. So when we look at our clients' portfolios and the companies that they're invested in, the strategies that they're invested in, we think that looking at the environmental profile, the social profile, the governance profile of those companies and investments is really important. And it's not extra financial. In fact, it's material to financial returns. And companies that manage those issues well are better managed in general and have a tailwind.
And so these other attributes that play into these values that matter, social, ecological, environmental values, are you finding it striking a nerve with a specific demographic at this point, or is it just more of an enlightened investor?
Well, I think the industry has changed over time dramatically. I mean, if you look at the roots of what was originally called socially responsible investing, it started in the religious communities that didn't want to invest in sin stocks, so tobacco companies, alcohol companies, et cetera. And what's happened over the years and the decades, particularly over the last 10 to 20, is that it's become more of an institutional level exercise in risk management. And so the growth of the industry, which now we call sustainable investing and impact investing, has been quite substantial. I think, you know, the clients we've had the longest tend to be more cultural creatives, entrepreneurs that have made their own money, and they want to put it to work in ways that align with what they believe in and who they are. We've worked with lots of people in the music and entertainment industry that fit that same kind of cultural creative. And of course, now we're seeing more and more of a shift of generational wealth, more women, more millennials that are investing this way as well.
I find it interesting, as you mentioned, that folks that are either utilizing their capital in a way and they're smarter in their approach, if they're looking out for these other attributes, those bottom line values you spoke to. Because I think one of the negative connotations with impact investing is that, boy, I'm not getting money, cents on my dollar back for this. I'm doing it because I believe in an initiative. But it seems there's been a sea change there. It seems that we can invest in things that we do believe in, that we think can do right. But you can also have a pretty positive return associated to that.
Yeah, that's right. There isn't a give up. And what the research has shown is that actually investing with this lens is a tailwind to long-term performance. So that there isn't any negative impact on the portfolio. So, you know, I mean, we look at the returns that we've generated in our stock portfolios, for instance, and they've beat the benchmark over the years. So, you know, those are positive results. And, you know, I think it's interesting when you look at investment management in general, 80% of active managers don't beat the benchmark. And I think, you know, from where I sit and where we sit at Arjuna, there is this sort of, at least I know I hold it, there's this real drive to outperform. Because, you know, not only are we, doing right by our clients when we do so, but we're also proving the thesis that this is a better way to invest. And, you know, fundamentally, I just think that's a really important message for people to hear.
Yeah, it's interesting that you are defining paving new paths here. And I find it interesting specifically that preamble to begin with, we talked about gender pay equality, but from what I read in your background was connected to looking at environmental aspects first. Mm-hmm. I read in your bio that you had a 2014 landmark negotiation with ExxonMobil that led to the company's first public report on global warming and carbon asset risks. So please, if you could tell us more about that process and then the result. And then now 5 years later, how did that approach teach you to use that framework, that model in your current work?
Yeah. So one of the things that we do on behalf of our clients in order to activate their voice and take their money, which, you know, for a lot of folks, it's like, you know, you invest your money, you're sort of not paying attention to it. It's in the closet. You look in and you're like, oh, I don't really like what I see. You know, maybe you're invested in private prisons or big oil companies or the like. And, you know, people often turn away from it. And what we really want investing to be is a socially constructive exercise. And so our clients, just like any other investor, has a stake and is an owner in the companies that they invest in. Now, when you think about a company like ExxonMobil, ExxonMobil is not in the majority of our client portfolios. We don't think that it's a sustainable investment. In fact, we think there's a lot of headwinds, financial headwinds that are facing the oil industry in general. But we do have clients that have held the stock for a long time, or, you know, they may have inherited it and held it at low cost and want to exercise their voice as shareholders. And so on their behalf, we will file a shareholder proposal. And so I'll just take a minute to say what that is,
Please.
Because it's a very interesting tool that I think is underutilized by investors in general. So a shareholder proposal is really just 500 words saying, hey, you know, company A, I think you should do this for this, that, and the other reason. And it goes onto the ballot at the company's annual meeting for other shareholders to weigh in on. So in the case of Exxon, you know, we're looking at what's happening, this existential crisis of climate change, particularly for the oil industry, and folks like Exxon and Chevron, and saying, hey, you know, is this going to impact your business? Because we've heard nothing from you that it is. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we can only burn a third of the oil reserves that are currently on the balance sheets of these companies without global temperatures exceeding more than 2 degrees Celsius. So that's a big deal, and it's a big risk. So in 2014, we filed a proposal. It went in front of Exxon. They actually went to the Securities and Exchange Commission and tried to fight the proposal. And in this case, we won that battle. And like literally the next day, they came to us and said, okay, we'll write the report, because they didn't want it to go to a vote to all their shareholders and be sent out to all their shareholders. And the report that came out of that, I mean, it was really a landmark negotiation, because despite the fact that investors had been asking for this, that, or the other thing on climate change for years and years, they had never done anything before. And so, you know, maybe a month later, they came out with this 30-page report called Managing the Risks, and within which they proceeded to deny all of the risks. So
risk aversion.
Yeah. So, I mean, our strategy with Exxon has changed over the years. We've asked for different things. We've asked them to return more dividends to shareholders so that shareholders can take that money and reinvest it in things that should be growing, whether it's renewable energy or other, you know, more sustainable solutions. This year, we actually have a proposal that's set to go on the ballot asking for a climate risk board committee, because we think that this crisis is so existential, it should be elevated to that level. But also really interestingly enough, and, you know, the fact is impact comes in different ways. The company is currently being investigated by the AGs of Massachusetts, of California, and New York for allegedly misleading statements that they put in that 2014 report.
I'd heard that the reason that Rex Tillerson took over the Secretary of State is because he didn't want to deal with you anymore, right?
That must be why.
Little did he know.
Yes.
That's right. So that is interesting in the fact that the shareholder proposal gives them the option, and it sounded like, as you mentioned, it gave them the potential to control their own destiny, to write up their report as they see fit. But it really greased the skids towards a conversation here. And if you get an ExxonMobil to talking about climate change, which is probably the lowest on the rung that are going to be doing this, then we're moving the ball here. There are some other tactics that I'd like to talk to you about. I want to come back to the shareholder proposal and blend this together with some of the work you've done on that pay equality side of things. But I'd like to discuss an approach or maybe a tactic of using shareholder pressure to change the company's stance and better mesh with evolving societal norms. And sometimes those processes are done by divesting. So getting to the intermediaries that work with endowments or foundations and having them pull their holdings in those fossil fuels or chemical companies, for example. So how do shareholders and stakeholders pressure their financial intermediaries around its allocation on company or companies that abuse the environment?
Yeah. This has been such a big issue for the past several years. And really, the divestment movement was one of the reasons that we went to Exxon in the first place, because it became, you know, there was a report that came out of London written by an organization, a consultancy called Carbon Tracker, that sort of proved this carbon accounting thesis. And Bill McKibben took that in 350.org and then, you know, really just went with it and started this divestment movement, which I think is, you know, there's a moral imperative, which I think that movement really pulls on. But as I said before, there's also a financial imperative. If we can't burn all of the oil that we have, if, you know, we look at things like renewables, et cetera, demand is going to go down over time. And that's not a good equation for the fossil fuel companies. So One of the pieces of my work, I am the board chair for an organization called the Intentional Endowments Network, and it works with colleges and universities and big endowments to say, you know, either, you know, are you going to divest or how are you going to intentionally invest? And again, that was sparked out of this divestment movement. What we've done at Arjuna is, For all intents and purposes, we've divested our clients, and we offer, and some of them are still transitioning over time, as you know, as happens. But we offer fossil fuel free investment solutions, whether that's public stocks, public bonds, private equity, or private fixed income across the spectrum. And despite that, as I said, you know, for our clients that do hold fossil fuels, we can engage with those companies. So it's not often you hear from some of the big pension funds, et cetera, it's like, well, we want to keep our seat at the table, so we're not going to divest. And it's like, you can still have a seat at the table. That doesn't mean you need to own billions of dollars of the stock.
Right.
In fact, you know, for like high net worth individuals that we work with, if they have $2,000 or more of company stock, they can engage as active investors.
It is fascinating. You got a kind of a multiple approaches there. You can, as you said, if you need to take that hard-handed approach and pull money completely, and if you're that large of a player, that will have impact on these organizations, or at least to express to them there's concern, or even on the shareholder proposal side. I mean, I would think that the energy companies that have now invested significantly in alternative methodology of creating energy in the future, the Saudis, Shell being a good example, that are putting significant amounts of capital because they've come to those realizations that we only have a certain amount of energy or to burn in a fossil fuel approach, or that we can't burn at all, or we're going to be in a tough situation, and that the future generation of consumers care about these things. So they're servicing,
that's right,
and that's what we see in food all the time, is our best friends in the long horizon here are going to be big food companies that get the idea, that gain the insight that the future consumer is one that cares about many of these values that you've described as a bottom line value.
That's right. Yeah, and I think that there's multiple approaches, as you said. When I was recently describing it, and I described sustainable investing and our approach to it as it's like building a layer cake, and everybody likes cake, so I think this is a good metaphor. But at the base layer, you know, what are you not investing in? What are you divesting from, right? And that can be everything from fossil fuels, as we just discussed, to you know, other things that kill people and our environment, like tobacco or nuclear weapons. The next layer of the cake is, you know, what are you going to invest in? So what are those solutions? Like, you know, you're seeing at Shell this diversification into other energy solutions. What are the solutions that we need to transition to a more sustainable economy? Because there is a secular tailwind there, right? Those are the companies that need to grow and where there will be a lot of demand. The third is, you know, we talked about this at the beginning of the show. How are you analyzing the companies that are in the portfolio from an environmental, social, and governance standpoint, so from this ESG standpoint, and choosing kind of best-in-class companies? And then the fourth is to engage, and how are you engaging with the companies that you own? When we engage with companies, we're always doing it with the business case in mind, for the investment case. So whether it is, you know, this existential crisis facing oil companies, why they need to prepare for these risks, why they should be diversifying into renewables, or with the gender pay gap, which we spoke a little bit about so far. You know, it's better business to pay women fairly, both for the work that they're doing today and to move more women up the pipeline into leadership positions, because when there's more diversity at the top, there's better decision making and better financial decisions. So there's these win-wins, and we're always looking for what is the win-win.
Hmm. Let's continue that. So last year you had an interview with Fortune magazine. You stated that Arjuna, I'm saying that wrong. I know I said it every time. Arjuna.
Either way.
I want to get it right. So Arjuna Capital is a wealth management firm focused on sustainable impact investing. We look to widen the lens on how we evaluate our investments, taking into account environmental, social, and governance criteria, and looking beyond traditional methods methods of analysis to incorporate the sustainability factors. So when it comes to pay gap, we're asking companies to close the gender pay gap and commit to keeping it closed. Now, you've been a powerhouse in making the biggest companies in the land adhere to changing societal norms and common sense approaches, you just stated. Your work has instigated pay equality for women at giants like Apple, Intel, Microsoft, financial institutions like JP Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, MasterCard, and retail players like Amazon, Nike, and Starbucks. Those are not small companies. I think it is listed maybe 10 of the Fortune 10 companies right there. So with all the pressure that they've received in the last 10 years, I'm going back to Obama's first term, thinking when people were more enlightened in decision-making process, where women were empowered to have these conversations of saying, what do you mean? There shouldn't be any gap in pay. We do the same work, right? To have that parity in pay for women, why did they decide to listen to you on pay equality for gap? I'm not questioning anything, but it's like, what was that finally got there? What was the straw that broke the camel's back? What did you do that was different than everyone else?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we brought it sharply into focus. So I kind of laugh at this. When I started this work, I didn't realize that my job as a financial advisor actually has the largest gender pay gap in the country. So there's some irony here. But, you know, when we first started out, we went to one company, a tech company, eBay. We saw that Silicon Valley, which had just started to put out their demographic numbers, had a women problem, mostly that there weren't any. And we said, you know, this isn't good. What we know from the research is more women lead to more innovation. Actually radical innovation, which for tech should be job one. Having more balance in gender in leadership leads to better performance, return on equity, profit margins, stock price performance, better decision making, all of these things. I mean, even in the investment advisory business, women managers are supposed to or are shown to outperform men because they're not so risk-taking. One might think, oh, well, if you're not taking risk, you know, there's not going to be the big return. But over time, you know, if you're having a more balanced approach, it's actually going to lead to long-term outperformance. So we went to eBay the first year, filed a proposal, just a pilot. This was 2014. And they came back and said, no, we're not going to do this. And they got some negative PR and our proposal went to a vote of shareholders, only got an 8% vote. Hmm. Right. And I'm like, okay, well, emerging issue. This is the first time shareholders have ever weighed in on this. So I think, you know, one of the things about me, I'm not to be deterred. I'm very persistent. And so the next year I rolled it out to 9 financial tech firms. And Intel actually was the first to come to the table and say, okay, we'll do it. You know, we don't need this to go to a vote. We agree we're going to publish our equal pay for equal work number. And after eBay, it was sort of like a domino effect, you know, then we got Apple and we got Microsoft and we got,
Amazon, Nike, Starbucks,
yeah, all of those. Companies. And this that second year, The proposal went to a vote again at eBay, and it got a 51% vote of shareholders, which in this field in sustainable investing, that's sort of a unicorn. You know, you don't need a majority vote for management to pay attention.
Yeah.
But holy cow, if you get it, that's pretty remarkable. So we knew we had something, and then we took it and we did the same thing. You know, if you can look at the tech industry and say, okay, that's the boys club of the West. What's the boys club of the East? Well, it's finance. So we did the same thing on Wall Street. And, you know, we got Citibank, and then just like, again, like dominoes, they all decided to disclose. Now, that said, we had a huge breakthrough this past week with Citigroup. Last year in 2018, on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, they were the first Wall Street firm to agree to publish their equal pay for equal work number. So that's you and me, we're working the same position, same seniority, same geography. Are we being paid the same?
Mm-hmm.
And on that day, they gave raises to women and they gave raises to minorities. So they did it not just for women, but we've asked for racial intersectionality. So they also did it for minorities in the United States. That was a big deal. So, you know, at the end of this year, I think we had 23 companies in the U.S. that had agreed to publish their equal pay for equal work number. This season, this proxy season, we've gone back and said, okay, equal pay for equal work is the first step. Making sure women are being paid fairly for the work that they're doing today is really important because it means that companies are going to be able to retain women, you know, better from a recruitment standpoint and better to move them up the ladder. But it's only half of the equation. So what is the median pay gap? And you spoke of that actually at the top of the hour. And, you know, that gap is wide in the U.S. You know, women make that are working full time make 80 cents on the dollar versus their male counterparts. And globally, I think, what was it, Korea that had 37? Was that the, oh yeah,
yeah.
Just terrible. So in the UK in April, US firms with UK operations and UK firms for their UK operations had to publish their median gaps. And so this year, what we did is we've gone back to a bunch of the companies we've engaged before and said, okay, there's the equal pay for equal work gap, and then there's the median gap. And you need to publish both. Otherwise, you're not telling the whole story. Because one shows if women are being paid fairly now. The other shows structural inequity within the company, that men are holding most of the higher paying jobs. And that's something that needs to change over time. It's not going to be solved overnight. But just this past week, Citigroup, who was the first bank to step up last year, stepped up again this year, and they published their median gap, and it was 29%.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, it takes a lot of bravery to do that, and it shows a lot of leadership. So, you know, we're hoping that their peers will follow.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's interesting because it is so timely today, but when you started this, it wasn't timely. I mean, you kicked off a lot of these conversations. I would say that gender pay gap is one of the conversations that got things going around what we now have for an influx of women in political leadership. We've seen new roles taken in senior management, C-suite folks within these organizations as well. And these are people that are qualified in every right to have these roles and maybe didn't get access to them before. So do you see that as being a bit of a snowball effect of an awareness?
I think that there is such a shift. I mean, you know, we're part of it. We're certainly not the only catalyst. But I look at what happened in 2016 when we got 7 out of those 9 tech companies to move. That year, equal pay became like the topic of the year. And you even saw slightly infuriating Super Bowl ads on equal pay. I think there was a Budweiser ad that was particularly bad. But it just showed that concept was being mainstreamed. And, you know, since then we've had the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
My gosh, watching the women rolling across the screen from the midterms. I mean, we've never seen anything like that in our lifetime. It was absolutely incredible. And I also think, you know, sort of the pushback to our political reality and having Trump in the White House who has had these accusations against him and is, you know, frankly, not a friend to women. A lot of women have stepped up. And that's been a huge catalyst. So we can say thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Trump.
That's right. He's the great uniter.
Yes.
He makes us all hate
yes.
him.
So there you go. So it is, you know, there's a big shift that's happening. And I think, you know, when you look at it at the more macro level, you know, I often think about like, well, you know, we've got this work that we're doing from the investment standpoint on gender. We have this work on climate change, and we've got other stuff that we're doing as well. But, you know, so much of this is about who holds the power and how are decisions made. And if you look at the symptom of climate change, for instance, it shows a broken power structure where decisions haven't been taking that risk into account. There hasn't been a quality of voices at the table. And we're really, you know, headed towards this this precipice, and we've got to turn it around big time, and it's a, you know, all hands on deck endeavor. So it's all connected, and I'm so encouraged to see more women stepping up.
As am I, as a son, a husband, and a father. It's just common sense for some. It's the way we should do it. It almost becomes infuriating. So good for you for stepping up and making it happen. And it sounds like it's an exciting opportunity for the business as well, because I'll stitch it together by saying expectations show that within the next decade, $41 trillion will be inherited by millennials. Now, a reason I mention that up is we had John DeLaVolpe, who runs polling for millennials at the Kennedy School, and he talks about in detail in all of this reports that the millennials will spend their resources on things that they believe in, both their time and their capital. Now, if they're going to inherit all of these resources, that should change the paradigm of how we're investing in things over the long horizon. I mean, I'm going to ask you to put a couple hats here, and of course we're doing this for the right reasons, but this is pretty good business development, isn't it, for the future of investing in these types of initiatives?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, you want to be moving with the direction of the tide. You know, I feel blessed. I am an elder millennial. So I'm blessed to be part of that cohort and, you know, and see those shifts and, you know, the shift towards people making decisions based not only on money, but on their values, how they think about the world, where they see the world going. And, you know, that's inspiring. Yeah. So I think there's a move towards integration. And when we look at what people, you know, how people are investing their money, there's a huge opportunity to integrate that in a way that fits with who you are, and, you know, put that money to work towards the solutions that, you know, we so desperately need.
I like that. Elder millennial. That's not, that sounds so good. It's like I'm the community elder of the millennials.
I'm 36. So
that's right. It is. You're in the bucket, but it's just a great way of phrasing it. It's like, oh, I'm still young and making stuff happen, but I'm the elder millennial. That's good.
Yeah. Well, we were still, I think in my cohort, we were still raised a little bit like the previous generations, a little bit more hands-off, although I'm fully a helicopter parent myself.
Yeah. I know. It's challenging not to. Right? A little more on your background. So Natasha works with clients to integrate environmental, social, and governance factors in their investments, while engaging major corporations to improve their performance through shareholder activism. Named by Bloomberg Businessweek as one of the Bloomberg 50 most influential people who define global business in 2017, Natasha was also featured on the cover of the magazine in June 2017. In 2018, she was named InStyle Magazine's The Badass 50.
I liked that one.
I like that's a good one. That's like, put that up on the wall. Women are changing the world. And you've been profiled in Forbes and Fast Company, The Globe, Rolling Stone, Economist, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, NPR, CNN. Awesome stuff. So you have incredible press and notoriety for the hard work that you've put in as a elder millennial. For this much needed and timely work, as we talked about. But so what comes next for yourself and for Arjuna Capital?
So, I mean, you know, my New Year's resolution was to keep doing what I'm doing, not to add anything new, but just do it better. Hmm. So, you know, we're continuing to grow the business, focus on our products, the campaigns that we have. I mean, we've got three really strong campaigns right now, the climate risk committees at Exxon and Chevron, the gender pay committee, the gender pay work with the median gaps with tech firms and Wall Street firms. And we also have a really interesting campaign going on with Facebook and Google and Twitter on content governance. And we were interestingly, because I learned this in the New York Times expose on Facebook and Sheryl Sandberg, we were the first to ring the bell on what happened with the Russians on Facebook in terms of election interference. So after the 2016 election, there was a big article that came out and said that, you know, fake news stories were outperforming real news stories. And in December of 2016, we filed the first shareholder proposal saying, hey, what's going on with fake news and election interference? And Facebook ignored us. And then it turned out that 126 million Americans were viewing Russian propaganda in the lead up to the election. So that is an ongoing conversation. And, you know, we'll continue just going at that as well.
Let's hope they're as stand up as a city was in recognizing where they can improve things and make things better. Because
it's been a little rougher than that.
Yeah, what I've seen on the Hill is definitely something different than that. A lot of pleading the fifth, right, and shuffling. So content governance, that's very interesting, and it's essential for us now. And that Frontline special, that I don't know if you saw that, the two-part series on what was happening at Facebook, fascinating. That was just the levels and the depth that how invasive this was within different demographics in this country and how bombastic it was. And actually, maniacally genius.
Oh, I mean, totally.
Right?
Completely. So manipulated. Everybody was so manipulated.
Yeah.
It's just insane.
Right. I mean, just talk about feeling like he got played.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The problem now we have is that people still can't get past their buyer's remorse and still are supporting what we got there. But that's okay. That's another, that's your next problem to tackle, right?
Nope.
Transformative information share. So,
It's more about how do we uphold our democracy through having an educated electorate, which is incredibly important. And if companies are contributing to having an uninformed electorate, that's a big problem.
It is a big problem. Where can our listening audience learn more about your work and future speaking engagements coming up this year?
Sure. So you can check us out at arjunacapital.com. So arjuna-capital. We have a Facebook page. We're on Twitter, all of that, those social media pieces. And, we're out and we're talking about it.
So it's easy for people to find one of those three subcategories, whether it's environmental issues, gender pay equality, or content governance. They can easily find that information that you have available on the website.
Yeah, just go on our news page and there's volumes.
Very good. I will include a link at the end of the write-up and then also on our iTunes account that goes directly to you. I'll just say that I am thoroughly impressed. I like your cake analogy of the starts with divestment and then the concept of invest in what, then your assessment comes into play and the engagement side of things. Seems like a good strategy for more investors to adopt to get away from additional deal creation and focus on value creation. Your methodology of looking at the concepts of the new bottom line that integrate values as associated in your investing, where you're putting your resources to work for things that you believe in, I think will strike a nerve with many of your future investors. So congratulations on all of the hard work and all the accomplishments thus far. I look forward to seeing more great things, Natasha.
Thank you very much, Aaron.
I appreciate you taking the time. I learned a great deal, and I know our audience will as well. So thanks again.
Cheers.